live to the BBC for some news from around the world.
Hello, I'm Moira Alderson with the BBC News. The United Nations Security Council has, for the first time, adopted a resolution demanding an immediate ceasefire in Gaza and the immediate and unconditional release of all hostages. The Palestinian envoy to the UN, Riyad Mansour, said the Security Council should now see through the implementation of the resolution.
Security Council resolutions are binding, and if Israel is not going to implement it, then it is the duty of the Security Council to use Chapter 7 to take measures and punitive measures in order to make them obey the resolution of the Security Council. We are not done.
The Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said the US decision not to use its veto was a clear retreat from its previous position. President Vladimir Putin has for the first time acknowledged that radical Islamists carried out Friday's attack on a Moscow concert hall that killed nearly 140 people and wounded scores. But he again suggested, without providing evidence, that the assailants were somehow linked to Ukraine, an allegation Kyiv has dismissed as ridiculous. Here's Danny Eberhard.
3 days have passed since both the massacre itself at the Crocus City concert hall and the first claim of responsibility by the militant group Islamic State. That's the length of time it's taken President Putin to pin the blame on radical Islamists. Earlier in the day, the Kremlin had refused to answer a question about the Islamic State's claim. The group has published graphic footage of the attack. But Mr. Putin appears determined to pursue what he's claimed is a link to Ukraine, despite providing no concrete evidence of one.
The wife of the jailed Russian opposition figure, Vladimir Kara-Murza, has warned that the lives of many political prisoners in Russia are in danger. Yevgenia Kara-Murza included her husband in that category, following the death last month in a Russian jail of Alexei Navalny. She also said Friday's attack on the Moscow concert hall would be used as a pretext for more arrests.
And I believe that this terrorist attack will just further deteriorate this situation with labelling even more people as terrorists and those undermining the security of the state. It truly scares me how this regime uses these things to further toughen its grip on power and to further repress society.
Donald Trump has condemned the decision of a judge to confirm the start date of his trial over hush money payments, calling it election interference. If the trial in New York begins in 3 weeks' time as planned, Mr. Trump will be America's first ex-president to be subjected to a criminal trial. He said the ruling was designed to prevent him from campaigning in November's US presidential election. World News from the BBC. The United States and Britain have both accused China of being behind a cyber espionage campaign that targeted millions of people. In London, the Deputy Prime Minister, Oliver Dowden, said attacks hit the Electoral Commission as well as parliamentarians.
The UK does not accept that China's relationship with the United Kingdom is set on a predetermined course, but this depends on the choices that China makes. That is why the Foreign Office will be summoning the Chinese ambassador to account for China's conduct in these incidents.
In Washington, the FBI said the aim of the operation was to repress critics of the Chinese regime, compromise government institutions, and steal trade secrets. The Chinese embassy in London rejected the accusations. The Venezuelan president, Nicolas Maduro, has been officially registered by his party as a candidate for July's presidential election. With only a few hours to go until the deadline for registration expires, it's uncertain whether the opposition candidate, Corina Yoris, will enter the race. She stepped in as a substitute after the opposition leader, Maria Corina Machado, was barred from running for alleged financial misconduct. Reports from southwest Pakistan say gunfire could be heard near a naval base in Balochistan province close to the border with Iran. They said suspected militants had launched an attack on the PNS Sadiq air station near the city of Turbat. It's not immediately clear whether the base had suffered any damage. The Brazilian footballer Vinicius Junior has been applauded by journalists after breaking down in tears during a press conference whilst addressing the recurring racist abuse he's been subjected to whilst playing in Spain. Speaking ahead of Brazil's friendly match against Spain on Tuesday, the Real Madrid star said he was frustrated with efforts to tackle the abuse, but that he would not be forced out. The 23-year-old's been subjected to slurs from opposition fans on numerous occasions. BBC News.
This is Sean Bull and Rachel Fields with your local news coming to you live from the WORT studios on Bedford Street in beautiful downtown Madison.
Republican Congressman Mike Gallagher will step down this month, shrinking the slim Republican majority in the U.S. House of Representatives. Gallagher represents Wisconsin's 8th District, which includes Green Bay, Door County, and a swath of northeastern Wisconsin. Gallagher will make his early exit in about 4 weeks on April 19th. That's too late in the year to hold a special election to replace him, meaning the seat will stay vacant the rest of this year. And it means that going forward, the Republican majority in the House is that much more tenuous, only able to afford to lose one vote along party lines. Gallagher's announcement doesn't have Republicans pleased. Yesterday, Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene, a Republican from Georgia, called on House Speaker Mike Johnson to expel Gallagher before his resignation date. Last month, Gallagher announced that he would not seek re-election for a fifth term in Congress. And so far, two Republicans have announced they're running for the seat, reports Spectrum News. Both candidates are either current or former state senators. Roger Roth, a Republican from Appleton, served in the state Senate for 8 years until 2023, representing parts of the congressional district. And Andre Jacques has represented Door County since 2019 in the state Senate and 8 years in the state assembly before that.
Meanwhile, Assembly Speaker Robin Voss is calling for the disbarment of Michael Gableman, a former state Supreme Court justice. Gableman also led a taxpayer-funded probe into the 2020 presidential election, which turned up no evidence of wrongdoing. At the time, Gableman was hired by Assembly Speaker Robin Voss, who instigated the probe. During Gableman's more than a year tenure in leading the probe, he was sued for allegedly violating open records laws and racked up legal fees. Those fees, plus the price of the probe itself, cost taxpayers more than $2 million. In an interview this weekend, Voss told WISN-TV that his hiring of Gableman was, quote, the single biggest embarrassment I have ever had, unquote. That echoes previous characterizations from Voss. When he ended the investigation and effectively fired Gableman, Voss called the former state justice a, quote, embarrassment to the state, unquote.
A Dane County supervisor has resigned her position on the county board only to accept a job as the new chief of staff for the same board, reports the Capital Times. The switcheroo has some supervisors raising their eyebrows at the process, but Dane County Board Chair Patrick Miles tells the Cap Times that the process was by the book and above board. Former Supervisor Cecily Castillo represented the County Board's District 7, which covers much of West Madison, including the Greenbush, Vilas, Dudgeon Monroe, Westmoreland, Midvale Heights, and Summit Woods neighborhoods. Castillo is the sole candidate on the ballot next Tuesday, but tells the Cap Times she'll decline to be sworn into her seat. After next week's election, the County Board will need to fill the vacancy. A special election is slated for next spring.
After a national search process, Madison knows its new director of the Madison Public Libraries. Tana Elias, who has worked for the Madison Public Libraries for more than 3 decades, beat out 2 other finalists in the search process, both of whom were from out of state. Elias is currently the MPL's Digital Services and Marketing Manager. In that and previous roles, she's led rebranding and strategic and planning efforts, managed staff and community engagement initiatives, and implemented innovative services and programs. She holds a master's in library and information science from UW-Madison. Her hire to head up the library system first needs to be formally approved by the Library Board and the Madison Common Council. She's slated to become library director on May 12th.
Dane County is looking to expand a first responders program for nonviolent incidents to communities outside of Madison, Dane County Executive Joe Parisi announced today. Cities, villages, and towns adjacent to Madison have until April 17th to apply for a grant to expand the CARES program to their area. The CARES program dispatches teams of workers, one community paramedic from the Madison Fire Department and one crisis worker from the Journey Mental Health Center, to certain calls for service. It started off as a city program in 2021, then it was a small concentrated pilot program covering just part of Madison and had limited hours. Since then, it's continuously expanded its staffing, reach, and hours of operation, and it's responded to more than 4,000 calls for service and now covers all of Madison. Today's announcement was foreshadowed by an announcement last summer, when Dane County was selected to participate in a program run by Harvard University that explores alternatives to police responses to mental health emergencies.
Meanwhile, the Madison Police Department has resumed the use of a third-party commercial service for transporting people for emergency detention to Winnebago Mental Health Facility. The MPD tested out the option last summer in a pilot program. It has $100,000 to use for these services allocated in this year's budget. MPD officials point to the time-consuming nature of the transports. Transporting people to just outside Oshkosh required two police officers to make the trip per patient. Each drive takes almost 4 hours round trip, soaking up police time and city resources. The third-party service is with Green Bay-based service Ready Transports, formerly known as Wisconsin Lock and Load. As WORT has previously reported, Brown County suspended their contract in 2022 with the company following a prisoner escape at the Chicago O'Hare Airport, reports the Green Bay Press Gazette. The prisoner had been accompanied by a lone driver and had managed to elude him in the crowded airport. The county found that Reddy had erred in assigning only one driver to the transport.
About 17,500 absentee ballots have been issued to Madison voters for next week's spring election. As of this morning, less than half of those ballots had been returned back to the Madison Clerk's Office. And today is Mail It Back Monday, when the Clerk's Office encourages you to mail back your absentee ballot by today if possible. That allows a full week for the ballot to travel through the USPS and be delivered in time to be counted. You can also deliver your ballot to any in-person absentee voting site. Times and locations are available at cityofmadison.com/clerk. The clerk's office hangs on to your absentee ballot until Election Day, when it is distributed to your polling place to be counted.
And now, on to today's top stories.
In 1 week, voters will decide who sits on the Dane County Board. District 22 represents the villages of DeForest and Windsor, and two candidates are vying for the seat, incumbent supervisor Maureen McCarville and challenger Rebecca Witherspoon. Earlier today, Witherspoon shared her priorities with WORT news producer Faye Parks.
Thank you for joining me, Rebecca.
Hello. Thanks for having me on.
So to start, can you tell us a bit about yourself? What is your background and what political experience do you have?
Well, as you know, my name's Rebecca Witherspoon. I'm a wife. I'm a mom of two adult children. I've got three amazing granddaughters. I hold college degrees in IT network security and criminal justice. I've worked for more than 25 years in the legal field. I own and operate my own travel business, and I'm currently a trustee on the Village of DeForest Board and have been since 2021, as well as the Community Development Authority there in DeForest.
So can you walk me through some of the work that you've done since elected to the board there?
First and foremost, I've worked really hard to help increase transparency because there was a lot of murkiness for people. They didn't know what was going on in the village. And when they would try to find out things, they felt not heard. They didn't feel like they were getting the information that they needed to be able to understand what was going on. To be perfectly honest, I don't think they were treated as respectfully as they should have been when they sought information or shared their concerns. So when that happened, I ran for office and had a lot of support, got elected to the board, and ever since then, I have been working diligently to help improve the communication flow back and forth between village staff, the village board, and people in the village. And it's improved dramatically over the past 3 years. There's still work to be done. You can always improve that, but there's been significant improvement I reach out to folks in the village to make sure that they understand what is on the agendas, because the agendas are not always real clear as to what's important to pay attention to, what's not. I reach out to folks on anything I feel that they may have some concerns or feedback on to make sure that they have an opportunity. That has been really good. The other thing that I've really worked hard on is making sure that we're eliminating wasteful spending and that we're really being fiscally responsible with the money that the people in our village provide to pay for all the different services and things. Things like our police force, our municipal services, all the different things like that. Just making sure that things are done appropriately and fiscally responsible, which has helped reduce those really nasty increases in local taxes that have unfortunately happened at the Dane County level. So those are kind of the two broad things that I've done. There's a lot of other things. Those are probably the big ones.
So when it comes to this county board race, what are your priorities for District 22 specifically?
Specifically for District 22, I would say helping to be a voice to bring some sanity back to a very out of balance board. It's pretty one-sided right now, which really interferes with any kind of meaningful debate. Things like, for instance, the budget that just passed November, December, whatever it was, where there was a $30 million increase from last year, which resulted in a 14% increase for people's property taxes, which when you're in a time of hyperinflation, and you have been for several years, that really hurts the most vulnerable people in our community. I've talked with people who've been taxed out of their homes and they've had to move somewhere else because they just can no longer afford to live in Dane County, which is really a shame because this is a great county and we need to make sure that people who live here can stay here. The other thing is just to help bring back a more diversity of thought to the board so that if you lose debate about stuff, you don't get really good solutions. You get one-sided solutions that aren't always sustainable. And we need solutions that are sustainable and that don't inadvertently harm the people of the county, but instead actually help the people of our county. The county board has been a little bit too focused on things that they really don't have any control over. Some feel-good resolutions. They need to get back to the basics of what they're there for. Policy setting, budgeting, making sure our public services, our roads are well maintained. Our roads are the lifeblood of our economy. And if you can't get around safely, what business is going to come in if they can't get their products in and out?
So I know that criminal justice reform is a big talking point this year. What is your perspective on that?
Well, I do have a criminal justice background, so it's something that's near and dear to my heart. I've worked in areas of criminal justice throughout my career. I've worked with victims of domestic violence. I've worked with kids who have been taken out of the home for various reasons, whether it be abuse, truancy, any number of things. I've worked with people in drug and alcohol, substance abuse situations, and all of these different things, they're issues that people need help with. Just because you're experiencing a substance abuse issue doesn't necessarily mean you need to go be incarcerated. However, if they've been violent, if they have committed a crime, has harmed somebody, either a person individually physically or a business or whatever, then they need to at least be held accountable for that while they're getting some help for their substance use issues. I've looked into the CARES program that Madison has, and I think it's a great program, but I also think it's not funded the way it needs to be because if you're going to have mental health crisis workers embedded with your police, I think you need to have them 24/7 instead of just at certain times of the day because, I'm sorry, crises happen 24/7, not just during those time frames that they currently have them assigned. So I would really like to see programs like that, either within the cities or at the county level, expanded so that we can really help folk instead of just labeling them as bad. I don't think that's the proper way to go about things. People need help. It's a balancing act, and we need to find a way of both holding people accountable and helping them so that they can rise up and get past the issues that brought them there in the first place.
So meanwhile, Dane County Executive Joe Parisi's retirement is around the corner. What are your thoughts on that race? And if elected to the county board, how do you plan to handle the transition?
One of the things that I think is really important, I would like to see our next executive really get out of the comfort zone of the bubble of Madison and get out to the rest of the people in the county. Everybody in this county is affected by what that county board and what the county executive do. They need to be cognizant of that, and I don't know that they really keep that focus.
I think that covers all of my questions, but is there anything else you'd like to share with our listeners?
I have that proven record of consistently listening, fighting to reduce taxes while maintaining well-funded and efficiently run public services and works. And, you know, I ask those hard questions. I'm not afraid to do that. And I want natural spaces in our communities protected because as urbanization spreads, those natural spaces tend to get infringed on and they tend to disappear. So I'm really a big advocate on protecting those natural spaces. So I would just really be humbled and love to earn folks' vote on April 2. And if anybody ever has a question, I encourage them to reach out to me either through Facebook, my village email address, or give me a call.
Thank you again for agreeing to speak with me, Rebecca.
Well, thank you too, Faye, for being diligent and following up to connect with me. I really appreciate that.
That was Rebecca Witherspoon, one of two candidates vying for the District 22 seat on the Dane County Board. District 22 represents the villages of DeForest and Windsor. We'll hear from her opponent, incumbent supervisor Maureen McCarville, later in the show.
And we're actually going to that interview right now. This is Maureen McCarville, incumbent supervisor, who talked to Faye Parks earlier today.
Thank you for joining me, Maureen.
Thanks for having me.
So to start, can you tell us a bit about yourself? What is your background and what are some of your accomplishments since being elected to the county board?
So I've been on the board since 2012. A little bit of my background. I'm employed at Madison Gas and Electric. I've been there 40 years. I'm a manager. Served in the military in the past, sat on the village board out here for a couple of terms and the police commission, and I'm a member of the American Legion and Friends of the Yahara. The things that I've accomplished, we've done a lot. Environmental things, we've done a lot of sucking the muck and cleaning up our rivers and streams. I chair Lakes and Watershed. We've been able to dredge the lakes in an effort to keep the water flowing, which then helps to mitigate flooding issues and those types of things. And the big one, I was on PP&J, or Public Protection Judiciary, for probably the better part of my terms on the board. And I also chaired that committee for a number of years. And we were able to finally, as you I'm sure know, pass the budget that would go towards getting the jail built, which was a huge project. It's the largest project in Dane County, and I'm proud that we finally got it over the finish line and we can provide a safe and humane place. If folks need to be detained, I think that's the right thing to do. And it will bring us also into compliance with what's required under the state. It will bring us into compliance with PREA. It will help to remove the threat of lawsuits in the event that something would happen, which possibly could have, you know, in the old jail. It will allow us to bring residents back to Dane County and house them here at home rather than in another county, which it makes it very difficult for families and friends to visit while they're being detained. It will provide programs for mental health and physical issues. And ultimately, the goal being to, if folks are detained, you know, when they come back home, that we turn them out in a better position than when they came in. It's all part of criminal justice reform. It's one piece, but it's one huge piece, and it's a very humane, needed piece that we needed to do. So that would probably be the biggest accomplishment in all the years.
What are your priorities for District 22 specifically?
Out here in District 22, and this is countywide, it's not just District 22. There are issues of housing, there are issues, you know, with growth, and those are probably some of the biggest issues. In DeForest, you know, I keep in close contact with our village president and with a number of the trustees, and, you know, from the housing standpoint, I would say we have three groups, right? There's the working group, the folks that live out here, but maybe, you know, they need housing that's more affordable. And then we have a second group of people, our seniors, who maybe have lived in their homes for years, and they would really like to maybe get into some housing better suited for folks as we age, but it is cost prohibitive to them. So if they can't afford it, they stay in their homes. So those homes that maybe would have been starter homes for young families, you know, it kind of shortens up that market. So you kind of got this bottleneck. We also, from the business standpoint, I went to the Chamber of Commerce yearly get-together here a week or two ago, and we heard from business owners that, you know, they need workers, but the workers need jobs that are going to allow them to live in the community in which they work. So what do we do about that? They may be coming in from Sauk or from Columbia County or Dodge County or some other county where it's cheaper to live than Dane County, but the pay for the jobs is better in Dane County. For those folks also, there can be issues of transportation. And so what do we do about that? And there's active discussions going on within the villages out here and the business owners and local officials trying to come up with what would be some good solutions. Now, we do have out by the Pink Elephant, which everybody knows about the Pink Elephant out here. There's a park and ride out there. So while folks, maybe if we find a way, say, to get a van or a bus that would pick folks up in neighboring communities and get them to a park and ride, you would still then have to escort them from or get them from the park and ride maybe to the place of employment. So there's that leg or that piece of it that we have to solve for as well. The growth itself out here is exploding. You know, we don't seem to have enough lots to accommodate the growth. And with growth comes a whole host of issues, right? So you want to do it smart. You want to be able to budget and plan and build. And then you're going to have to staff. If you add positions, you add infrastructure, you add roads, you know, you're going to want the amenities. You're going to want the trails. You're going to want the parks. You're going to want all of those things as well. And that all costs money. So then you need to balance your residential with your commercial. So the costs back to the taxpayer is as balanced as it can be and as fair as it can be. And so you have to be able to take a look at your services that you provide. So those are all issues being talked about on a regular basis. With the growth, it's not a relaxed conversation where you can talk about it forever, you know. Also, coordination of services. DeForest and Windsor are working together to coordinate delivery of those services to say, where can we partner on that stuff so that instead of having two of everything, maybe it's cheaper to have one and then cover both the areas. So anywhere that we can do those types of things is a plus back to the taxpayers.
When it comes to the county as a whole, we know that County Executive Joe Parisi's retirement is coming soon. So what are your thoughts on that race? And if reelected to the county board, how do you plan to handle that transition?
Hate to see Joe go. He's been a great county exec, been there for years. He has endorsed Senator Agard. I've endorsed Senator Agard as well. I served with her when I first came on to the county board. She's effective. She's thorough. She thinks through things. She gets things done. So I think we'll be in good, capable hands, assuming she would get the position. How do I see that going forward is I think anybody that is elected in Dane County for that position will most likely have a lot of the same priorities that Joe has had. So from where I sit, you know, having been on the board for years, I think there's a continuity of leadership that we'll still have with existing supervisors who will be still on the board. And we'll be able to help a new exec along the way as issues come up and we work through. It'll be work because it's going to be new for a lot of folks. Our chief of staff for county board retired. A number of the supervisors opted either not to run or have challengers and may not come back. So it's going to be a whole new ballgame. And I think everybody needs to buckle up, sharpen our pencils, stay on top of the game. You know, 90% of it's showing up and a willingness to dig in and deal with the issues and stay connected back to the community so that the information flow from communities into the county so that we're all understanding, you know, what's before us.
So before I let you go, is there anything else you'd like to share with our listeners?
Well, I'm very humbled to have served all these years and been elected back into the position term after term, and so I would be honored to have their vote yet again. You know, we'll do our best to keep Dane County a great place to live. I think that the fact that people are moving here in droves is testament to what a wonderful place we have, and we intend to keep it that way.
Thank you again for agreeing to speak with me, Maureen.
Absolutely.
That was incumbent supervisor Maureen McCarville, one of two candidates vying for the District 22 seat on the Dane County Board. District 22 represents the villages of DeForest and Windsor. We heard from McCarville's challenger, Rebecca Witherspoon, earlier in the show. Witherspoon and McCarville will face off on April 2nd.
BBC News with Moira Alderson. The United Nations Security Council has, for the first time, adopted a resolution demanding an immediate ceasefire in Gaza. It also demanded the release of all hostages. In a change of position, the US abstained. The Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said the US move marked a retreat. The United Nations has announced that the head of its humanitarian agency, Martin Griffith, will step down in June for health reasons. On Sunday, Mr. Griffith criticised Israel for not letting UN aid convoys into northern Gaza, saying this would push thousands closer to famine. The Russian president has for the first time acknowledged that radical Islamists were behind Friday's attack on a Moscow music venue, which left at least 139 people dead and many others injured. Vladimir Putin again insisted, without providing evidence, that the assailants were somehow linked to Ukraine, a charge Kyiv dismissed. Donald Trump has condemned the decision of a judge to confirm the start date of his trial over hush money payments, calling it election interference. If the trial in New York begins in 3 weeks' time as planned, Mr. Trump will be America's first ex-president to be subjected to a criminal trial. The United States and Britain have both accused China of being behind a cyber espionage campaign that targeted millions of people. Both countries have imposed sanctions against the alleged Chinese hackers involved. The Chinese embassy in London rejected the accusations. Reports from southwest Pakistan say gunfire could be heard near a naval base in Balochistan province, close to the border with Iran. There's been no comment yet from the Pakistani military. Zambia has agreed a revised deal to restructure nearly $4 billion of its international bonds with private investors. President Hakainde Hichilema has hailed it as an historic milestone. BBC News.
Hi, my name is Vicky Kenyon. I'm your host for this week's Access Hour on WORT Madison, and I am a connector. I have always loved connecting people with one another and connecting people to resources. As I dove into my second career as a realtor, I found that much of the queer and trans community on a national level is not connecting to home ownership in ways that the rest of our country does. I want to change that. My aim is to make a significant positive impact on queer and trans home ownership here in Dane County. So, after a lot of networking and a lot of planning, I gathered a team of four other professionals and launched a free educational series that provides resources and answers to questions around home ownership in an inclusive, welcoming, and safe space. And now, we bring our knowledge to you here. On this week's Access Hour, my team and I will be here talking Homeownership 101 and answering your questions live.
WORT thanks its listener sponsors and Five Nines, a locally owned cloud service provider of enterprise-level IT infrastructure consulting, hosting, and management services. On the web at fivenines.com. Phone number 512-1000.
The time is now 6:33, and you're listening to the live local news on WORT. I'm your host, Sean Bull, here with my co-host, Rachel Fields. Thanks for joining us.
It's Monday night. Do you know where your government is and what it's doing? It's time now for Forward Lookout.
And with me now is Brenda Conkle from ForwardLookout.com. How you doing, Brenda?
Oh, doing good today.
Good, good, good. So we're talking about what's happening this week in local government, and we're starting with Dane County. First up, tomorrow, 5:30, the Public Works and Transportation Committee has some interesting agenda items, don't they?
They do. They have their staff study report about the Alliant Energy Center. The county's been dealing with a lot of different studies of how staff are doing throughout various departments. So that should be interesting. They also are looking at ground and condominium leases at Tree Lane and Rethke. Looks like they have found a new developer to take over those projects. And the name of the developer is Sinair. So a couple of things of interest there. Those items will also be voted on by Health and Human Needs later this week.
Okay, let's go now to Public Protection and Judiciary Committee, and they are meeting, let's see, 5:30 Tuesday as well. So just one item, right? Two?
Yeah, they're going to be talking about a donation from American Family Insurance, and that donation will be for two reentry coordinator positions, which I think can be very welcomed by the community. They also are going to be looking at their end of term accomplishments. So the county board is going to be reelected in April, or new people will be elected in April. And so they're looking at what types of accomplishments they had over the last 2 years.
It does kind of seem like business is wrapping up for at least a little lame duck period or something right now. Not too much on the agendas. But what about Wednesday at 5:15, the Specialized Transportation Commission?
Yep, they'll be getting a presentation from Great Lakes Dry Hooch. That is an organization that works with veterans. And then they will also be getting some updates from the Transportation Call Center, as well as from the Greater Madison Metropolitan Planning Organization, which does a lot of the regional planning for City of Madison as well as Dane County.
And also Wednesday, the Park Commission. Looks like a hybrid meeting that starts at 5:30 on Wednesday.
They have a couple grants they'll be accepting, one for the Groundswell Conservancy and another for the Driftless Area Land Conservancy. They also will be getting some presentations, the Conservation Fund grant application. They'll be doing a presentation on that, as well as their education program. And then they are going to be looking at the public comments that they got for the Walking Iron Trail. And then finally, they are working on some meetings for the Parks and Open Space Plan. They'll be having a meeting on April 3rd at 7 o'clock, as well as April 15th at 7 o'clock, if you want to give input into the planning for the parks throughout Dane County.
Let's move on to the City of Madison, and 4:30 on Monday, it's the Finance Committee. The Finance Committee's been busy lately, and that is true of today as well.
Yes. They will be approving Megan Tuttle for the 5-year term to be the Planning Division Director. So they'd be the person who staffs the Plan Commission. And then they got a whole bunch of TIF district items. So they have some amendments for the Capital Gateway, Ringgra, Royster Clark, and State Lake. That would be the only ones. So they got 4 different amendments to TIF plans. You can only do an amendment 4 times, and some of these have to be reaching their end of their amendment periods. But lots of stuff going on with the TIF districts. They also will be looking at a bunch of contracts. They'll be setting the rates for the sewer and stormwater utility for 2024. And then they will also be, at the end of their agenda, they'll be talking about the American Rescue Plan update, so all of the COVID-related funding that they got, as well as looking at what type of guidance they want to give for the operating and capital budgets. And then they are also going to be requesting to the state to allow us to look at having a sales tax.
Oh, okay. I'm sure they'll just give it to us, right?
Right, exactly.
No one's ever thought about this before.
Right, exactly.
The Plan Commission, also meeting, also very lengthy agenda item. Can you run through what you think are some of the more bigger projects that they're taking a look at?
Sure. There's a big project at 428 to 444 State Street. And then they will also be looking at a project at 626 Langdon Street. And there is another project. Well, there's actually several small projects over in sort of more of the Regent neighborhood. And then there's a project out on Speedway Road.
And Wednesday, more design, more construction, 4:30, the Urban Design Commission meets virtually. And they'll be talking about signage modification on Odana Road, which we'd love to talk about.
Right. They also will be looking at a project for East High School. It's a public building, and they'll be talking about that. There's also a project out on Dutch Mill Road, on Badger Road, and then a new indoor storage facility on Pennsylvania Avenue.
And the Vending Oversight Committee meets Wednesday at 5 p.m. Important to the food scene. And what are they talking about?
They're going to be doing their 2024 special events programming, so they'll be looking at having special vending approvals so that one group can get the vending license for all of the food carts that will be at those events.
Also Wednesday, 5 p.m., Transportation Commission. They'll be looking at BRT, the north-south route. Anything else?
They'll also be looking at their 2023 annual report, and they're giving lots of feedback on some upcoming projects. So there's a project at Danbury, Beverly, and Doncaster, as well as Tonto Drive, Pheasant Branch Creek Path and the Ped Bike Bridge at Hermina Street. And then they'll also be looking at their upcoming budget for 2025.
And then 8 a.m. on Thursday is the Madison Metropolitan Sewerage District Commission. Kind of some big news they made when they, you know, a pipe burst and some sewage got out. Not great. So maybe they'll be talking about that. Maybe not. I don't know. Is that closed session? Is that what that's about?
I think the closed session is a personnel related matter, but I can't remember for sure. But they will be looking at all kinds of sewer extension plans. So out at the Village of Autumn Lake, DeForest Yard, Shady Grove replat, lots of expansion that the city of Madison continues to do.
Yes, indeed. All right. What about 5 p.m.? The Housing Strategy Committee is meeting virtually and they're looking at ADUs. What does that stand for?
Accessory dwelling units. So it's really mother-in-law houses or additional units that you can put on your property. They're looking at allowing up to 8 dwelling units and removing the owner occupancy requirement for accessory dwelling units. Be interesting to see how this one plays out. I believe there's a project on the north side that is the reason why they're doing this. They also are going to be looking at combining the Landlord-Tenant Issues Committee and the Housing Strategy Committee. That has been going on for about a year and a half now. We'll see once if that gets any further or not.
Lots more happening in Dane County and the city of Madison. So if you want to see those agenda items and which meetings and committees are taking place, just head on over to forwardlookout.com. Brenda, thank you so much for walking us through it.
You're welcome.
This Thursday, March 28th, is the 45th anniversary of the nuclear power plant accident at Three Mile Island. On today's The Past Isn't Past, feature contributor Harry Richardson has a story of government and corporate deception. But it's also a story of ordinary people fighting for the truth.
For Joe Hill and Cesar Chavez, who fought in their own time. For our brothers and our sisters, up and down that picket line. For the unnamed and unnumbered, who struggle brave and long. For the Union men and women, standing up and standing strong.
This Thursday, March 28th, is the anniversary of the 1979 partial meltdown at Three Mile Island nuclear power plant in Middleton, Pennsylvania. It was the worst nuclear disaster in U.S. history. Although later overshadowed by Chernobyl and Fukushima, it is vital to remember what happened at Three Mile Island. TMI. First, local residents' exposure to high levels of radiation at TMI was covered up by the utility and the government. Secondly, some nuclear power experts citing these three disasters say we may be overdue for another nuclear accident. Finally, there are cynical attempts by the nuclear energy industry to sell nuclear as a necessary clean energy amidst growing concerns over global climate change. Our story begins on March 28th when an accident at TMI Unit 2 melted radioactive fuel rods in the core of the reactor, and radiation began leaking in the early morning hours. Human and technical error had led to the leak. That evening, Walter Cronkite, then known as the most trusted man in America, opened his nightly newscast saying, "The world has never known a day quite like today. It faced the considerable uncertainties and dangers of the worst nuclear power plant accident of the atomic age, and the horror tonight is that it could get much worse." Cronkite went on to say that experts had wrongly ruled out the possibility of an explosion. However, Cronkite never disclosed the long-term impact. Significant radioactive fallout did escape from TMI, and that human beings were killed and maimed in great numbers, says anti-nuclear activist Harvey Wasserman, who called it one of the most heavily censored secrets of the nuclear age. Milltown Mayor Robert Reed was teaching at a local high school when he got the word, "Something is going down at the island." 2 days later, there was a hydrogen bubble at TMI that looked likely to explode and release radioactive material. The governor called for an evacuation of women and preschool-aged children, but most people had left on their own. 3/4 of the people left the borough, recalled the mayor. There was a run on the banks. Most people didn't return for a week or two. Some never returned. Shortly after the accident, there was a non-binding county referendum to keep the plant closed. It passed 2-1. The plant did not reopen until 1985, 6 years later. The site took 14 years and $1 billion to clean up. In the aftermath, a presidential commission intensified oversight of nuclear reactors, implementing new industry-wide standards. Many local residents became anti-nuclear activists, while others went back to work at the plant. The accident at TMI sent the whole nuclear industry into a tailspin. Already staggering under $100 billion in cost overruns, the industry could not counter the narrative of the accident showing nuclear power as expensive and dangerous. The nuclear industry turned a multi-billion dollar asset into a multi-billion dollar liability overnight and demonstrated that both the government and industry were thoroughly unprepared for the accident and its aftermath, said Jim Riccio, nuclear policy analyst for Greenpeace. Even the NRC, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, acknowledges there is no such thing as a safe dose of radiation. A 1997 peer-reviewed study by University of North Carolina's Dr. Stephen Wing found that lung cancer and leukemia rates downwind from Three Mile Island were 2 to 10 times higher than upwind after the accident. A new documentary on Apple Plus, Radioactive, The Women of Three Mile Island, highlights 4 women who became activists to find the truth after learning the government did not protect their families and that TMI's owners were lying. In one particularly disturbing scene, they noted how many of their family and neighbors had cancer, some of whom had died. Nuclear power plants are still a danger. The U.S. has 31 plants of the same design as GE's Fukushima plant that melted down in 2011. The storage of nuclear waste has never had a satisfactory solution. The NRC's official historian, Thomas Wellock, wrote a refreshingly candid book, Safe Enough, A History of Nuclear Power. Daniel Ford, who wrote books and papers on nuclear industry safety, has concluded that the nuclear industry has been compromised by safety shortcuts and lacks government regulation. In fact, large numbers of nuclear plants were only built after Congress passed legislation granting blanket protection from paying the full costs of accidents in 1957. There are 92 nuclear power plants near the end of their shelf life. Worldwide, there are 400 plants using U.S. or similar 60s and 70s designs, which have documented flaws not easily fixed. Solar and wind are the safest and cheapest way to go. And that is our story for today. For the past and the past, I'm Harry Richardson.
It's now 6:47 p.m. and you're listening to the live local news on WORT.
Today, Madison Mixology host Charlie Belosky pours us a double feature. In this episode, he'll teach us how to make both the black and white Russian and the history behind the cocktails.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Madison Mixology. I'm your host and favorite reporter, Charlie Belosky. Today, I have a double feature for you as I demonstrate how to make the black and white Russian. We'll start off with the black Russian. It's a step simpler to make and has its own quick history attached to it. Despite the name, the Black Russian is not actually from Russia. Similar to the Moscow Mule, it's simply called such because of the use of vodka as a base. Back in 1949, there was a bartender at the Hotel Metropole in Brussels, Belgium, named Gustav Tops. At the time, the United States ambassador to Luxembourg was a lady named Pearl Mesta, and Tops created the Black Russian to honor her and her work. Making it is an easy process for a very flavorful drink. To start, get your trusty glass and fill it with ice. Then add the 2 easy ounces of vodka. Any kind will do. Today, I have Tito's. Then you want to add about 2 to 3 ounces of coffee liqueur. My go-to is Kahlua. And there you have it. Super simple. But we aren't quite done yet. If we add a float of fresh cream over the top of this, we get the White Russian. The White Russian first popped up in 1965 in a copy of the Oakland Tribune. Back then, it was a Black Russian with Coffee Southern, a coffee liqueur made by Southern Comfort. After it was discontinued, it was replaced with half and half, or heavy whipping cream. Let's add the half and half and give this a try. If you're a coffee snob, you're going to really like this drink. The White Russian tastes like coffee, but with creamer added to it, and the Black Russian tastes almost like just straight black coffee, with the addition of alcohol, of course. It's very creamy as well, very smooth going down, but still has that burn in the back of the throat thanks to the vodka. It's a drink that goes down really smooth, but it's one of those that you have to be careful of because if you have too many of them, you don't taste the alcohol. You don't know it's alcoholic at first, except for that burn, you know? And I can definitely see a lot of people drinking way too many of these way too quickly and then just getting hammered really quickly. But it is very tasty. Probably one of my more favorite of the drinks that we've gone over so far. This drink was actually pretty quiet through the decades. After it was made in 1965, it kind of lost a lot of traction, just was like really silent for a time until 1988 when The Big Lebowski came out. One of the main characters, well, the main character, the guy named The Dude, was often seen in a lot of the shots with a White Russian in his hand. He called it a Caucasian, but anybody that knows mixology and knows what the White Russian looks like knows that, you know, it's a White Russian. And because of that, it caused an absolutely huge surge in the drink's popularity. And that combined with just the absolutely great taste that this drink has, it has made the drink a lasting addition to any bar. You know, just like all the other drinks I've taught you, there's a variety of different ways to make it, such as the blind or blonde Russian. It goes by both names. I tend to call it the blind Russian. And that uses Bailey's Irish cream instead of, you know, the regular like half and half or heavy whipping cream. There's others as well. A larger aspect of the drink actually involves adjusting the ratios of the vodka, the Kahlua, and the cream, though. Like, for example, me, I always love more cream and Kahlua and a little less vodka. It gives the drink a more enhanced sweet flavor, and it hides the alcohol kind of taste a lot better. And for me, I like my drinks like on the sweeter side, and so the less that I have to taste of the alcohol, the better. So my combination kind of, as I said, focuses more on the Kahlua and cream than it does the vodka. Plus it enhances the coffee flavor, which I very much like because I myself am a huge coffee snob. I would highly suggest trying your own combinations and see what works best for you. I'm your host, Charlie Bielowski. Thanks for listening to another installment of Madison Mixology.
Today, feature contributor Harry Richardson reviews two new movies on the small screen. Harry says the documentary Radioactive, The Women of 3 Mile Island, presents a moving story. And he says Shirley, which depicts political trailblazer Shirley Chisholm, is a solid feature film. Chisholm ran for president in 1972, the first African-American and the first woman to do so in a major political party.
This is my family that they played with.
Do not believe what the company tells you and question everything the government tells you.
That was a clip from the trailer for Radioactive, The Women of 3 Mile Island, directed, written, and produced by Heidi Huntner. It's Huntner's first film. She's an environmental humanities professor at Stony Brook University of the State University of New York. The documentary opens with the four women at the center of our story observing their annual commemoration of the 3 Mile nuclear power plant partial meltdown on March 28, 2018. The women, longtime friends and neighbors, join hands and remember the four, all mothers with young children then, fought for the health of their children in the aftermath of the 3 Mile Island TMI accident in 1979. They are Linda Hoagland Brosh, Beth Drozdba, Joyce Cordali, and Paula Kinney. The documentary focuses on the effects of that accident on the people who lived near the plant. These four women felt in the first few days after the partial meltdown that they would have to work together because the government wasn't protecting them or telling them the truth. Neither was the company that owned the plant. Huntner uses interviews with the women, footage and audio from the period, and present-day interviews to present a compelling story of what happened that day. She shows that the government and the company hid the truth from the media and the public. The focus on women discovered that women are far more at risk than men when exposed to radioactivity. Mary Olson, a biologist, founder, and director of the Gender and Radiation Impact Project, explains, "The men that set the radiation standards in the U.S. since the beginning of the nuclear research in 1942 based impacts on a 25 to 30-year-old male defined as Caucasian. She said it has become known as the reference man. However, Olson cites research finding that radiation is 10 times more harmful to young women and 50% more harmful to a comparable female, that is, to reference man, who is more resistant to radioactivity than a woman. Huttner interviews a whistleblower who worked at the plant about the cover-up of the seriousness of the accident and the amount of radioactive releases, especially of cancer-causing iodine-131 and xenon-133. One of the most heart-rending scenes is of the women recounting all the family and neighbors who have contracted cancer, some of whom have died. A well-done documentary. After a brief theatrical release, it has just started showing on Apple Plus and Amazon Prime. I highly recommend it. Up next, another story of a courageous woman from the 70s.
I'm going to force all the politicians to be held accountable.
You're going to do all that. School teacher from Brooklyn.
Harriet was just a slave. Rosa was just a domestic. What is it you do for a living again?
That was clipped from the trailer for Shirley, written and directed by John Ridley. Regina King leads a solid cast as Shirley Chisholm, the first black woman to win a seat in Congress in 1968. In 1972, Chisholm ran an uphill grassroots campaign for President of the United States. In a crowded field, she stood out as the only person of color and the only woman. She was the first woman and the first African American to run for president in a major political party. The film shows us what Chisholm overcame to run for president. The film opens with her first day in Congress in 1969. She is feisty and idealistic, not taking the Speaker of the House's assignment on the Agriculture Committee, which she considered an insult and irrelevant to her Brooklyn district. She persuaded the Speaker to put her on the Veterans Affairs Committee. Then our story jumps to her run for president. I would have preferred a story that began with her starting in politics in the 50s that led to her time in the state assembly and her run for Congress. The story we get is one of a woman who was unbought and unsold. She inspired the next generation of African-American politicians like Barbara Lee, now Congresswoman from California. She's played by Christina Jackson in the movie. In the film, she's a radical student won over by Chisholm, who facilitates a meeting with Black Panther Party leader Huey Newton, and one of the film's more amusing, interesting scenes. In the end credits, we see Barbara is Barbara Lee. Michael Shari does a fine job as her loyal, put-upon spouse, Conrad. Lance Reddick, Brian Stokes Mitchell, and Terrence Howard do a fine job portraying her chief campaign aides. A well-done film, well worth seeing. It just started streaming on Netflix. For WRT's Monday Movie Review, I'm Harry Richardson.
And that does it for our show. Thanks for listening to WORT's Live Local News at 6. Special thanks to feature contributors Harry Richardson, Charlie Bielowski, Brenda Conkle, and Dylan Broken. Thanks also to Bill Kingsbury for web production. Victor Calzoni engineered the show, Faye Parks produced this newscast, and news director Charlie Pittman wrote this evening's headlines. I'm your host, Sean Bull.
And I'm your host, Rachel Fields. Stay up to date with the WORT Local News Podcast. Subscribe on iTunes Podcast, Spotify, and wherever else you listen. Up next is the most freeform show on your radio dial, and it's called The Access Hour. Have a great night.
And you are listening to WORT 89.9 FM, Madison.
Do you care about workers and labor issues? Do you want to make a difference in our community for working people? Then join the Labor Radio team. Labor Radio is a weekly show that covers labor, social justice, and political issues that impact workers. And we need your help. As a Labor Radio volunteer, you will have the opportunity to report on important labor and social justice stories in your community, interview workers, activists, and experts, produce and edit your own stories. No prior experience is necessary, though a connection with labor is a plus. We will provide training and support. All you need is a passion for worker justice and a desire to amplify the voices of working people. To learn more, contact Volunteer Coordinator Adrian Rainey at 608-321-9583 or head online to WORTFM.org/volunteer to fill out an application. Labor Radio, a voice for workers.
Welcome to the Access Hour, where each week WORT offers you the opportunity to fly your program over the radio. The Access Hour is WORT's commitment to community access to the airwaves. For this hour, we have turned the airwaves over to a member of the public. The views expressed on the Access Hour do not represent the views of the station, its staff, programmers, or the board of directors. We'd like this show to be as unpredictable as possible, so we need your creative ideas. It's a fair trade. You give us what you've got, and we give you the facilities and any help you need to get your program airborne. So let your mind wander and wonder. And when the inspiration for some pretty good radio glows with a clear, bright light, get in touch. Just go to WORTFM.org and look on the left side for Sign Up to Host an Access Hour. Programs are scheduled first come, first served. And now it's time to begin another foray into the freest form program on the WORT schedule, the Access Hour.
Hello, welcome to the Access Hour. My name is Vicki Kenyon, and I'm going to be your host tonight. I'm a realtor with Stark Company Realtors. I've always loved connecting with people and connecting people to resources. So when I started my second career as a realtor, I found that much of the queer and trans community on a national level is not connecting to home ownership at the same rate as everyone else. So nationally, about 65% of